couldn't afford to do anything really except go to these fairs and, you know, whatnot. And I thought, well, how am I going to market this thing? How are we going to grow this thing? And I wasn't there very long when I could see all of, because I had access to some of the admin tools where you could sort of see who was online, what were the dynamics. You couldn't see what they were saying, but you could sort of, you could see a little bit of a dashboard in real time that it was full of people, and that these people were, you know, hooking up with each other in all sorts of ways. And, you know, it just hit me that the best thing that I could do would be to just make this experience be as meaningful as possible to everybody using it, so that they would be enthusiastic about it and get their friends to do it. I couldn't think of any other way to do it. And so when I realized that, then I very quickly saw that the key to the whole thing were the relationships between the individuals. You know, it wasn't, I mean, yeah, you want the software to work well and help you. You want certain things, but at its core, it was really about the relationships between the people and helping to build them.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, John Cote joins John and Scoop for a deep dive into the world of online communities. John was the first community manager for the pioneering online service, The Well. We discuss his experiences managing The Well and the current state of online communities.
Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia podcast. Scoop and I will be joined today by John Cote. John has spent much of his life managing online communities, including the seminal online community, The Well, or Whole Earth Electronic Link. He also managed community and set up a web news site for sfgate.com. And he's currently doing community management as part of the European Commission Next Generation Internet Initiative. John, you were early on part of the farm, the intentional community in Tennessee. How did you get from the farm to The Well?
I got to The Well from the farm in specifically because the first person to actually work at The Well, the guy who set it up. I know that Stuart Brand and Larry Brilliant certainly get credit for conceiving it and thinking it up, but the guy who actually set it up and then ran it for the first 9 months was Matthew McClure. And Matthew McClure, MMC at The Well, was and is a very close friend of mine who also lived at the farm. His connection to Whole Earth was that in the older Whole Earth days of the Whole Earth catalog, he was the typesetter. When they were located down near Stamford, Matthew had gone to Stamford, and you know, before the Whole Earth organization relocated itself up to Sausalito in the 70s, they were located down there near Stamford. And so Matthew, I don't know how he fell in with those guys, but he did. And then he left that organization to go be part of the farm. And then when the farm was kind of breaking up in the early 80s, in like 1982 and 3, Stuart got a big advance on a book called the Whole Earth Software Catalog, which didn't really sell too well, didn't go anywhere, but it had like the biggest book advance ever at the time. It was kind of, and so they hired Matthew to come and be an editor at the Whole Earth Software Catalog in Sausalito. And while he was there, a year or two into it, they came up with the Well idea. And Matthew had, I don't know if it was his major, but it was at least a minor for him at Stanford in computer programming. And so he just had the right combination of skills to actually put the thing together. And so they did. They physically put it together in at the Whole Earth office in Sausalito, which meant getting this deck, you know, digital equipment, VAX, that was about the size of a, well, it was like 1.5 times the size of a dorm refrigerator, let's say, something like that. One of those kind of rigs, and needed a lot of air conditioning and cooling, big power draw. That was in one room, and it had, you know, these huge hard drives that were 150 megabytes each. And they took basically 3 people to pick them up and slide them into the racks, with the third person basically having to squat over and hold the one end of it up on your back so you could slide it in. These things were incredibly heavy. And so there's this room that's, you know, tape and all of that business. And then in another room, there was modems and phone lines. And, you know, and so Matthew arranged to have all this stuff set up.
I'm thinking of some context we should probably give, which is, of course, Whole Earth was like, originally there was the Whole Earth catalog, and later there were other publications related to that. And Whole Earth spun off a number of things, and this was one of them. But this was also a pre-internet online community. And at the time, the kinds of technologies that you had to use for something like that were called bulletin board systems. And they were not necessarily connected to the internet, and the well wasn't connected to the internet.
Well, except
at first.
Well, except with this key exception.
Except for email, right?
Yes, that's right. Although it did receive very early a Usenet feed, and that was possible because the whole system ran on the Unix operating system, unlike every other BBS bulletin board system, which was, you know, basically PC level, you know, operating system and software. And the server would typically, you know, be a nice PC or something. This was Unix. And, you know, for those of you not familiar, I know everybody knows what Linux is. Linux is an open source derivative of Unix. Unix was developed in the 60s at Bell Labs, specifically as an operating system for communication and networking. And what is key about it, besides the fact that it, by default, basically put together a network, it was the DARPA net, all of that was run on Unix. It also had the characteristic of being changeable by people who knew how to program it. So it was also, it wasn't open source, but it was extremely malleable. And so this enabled the well to get on to direct email connection with all of the other systems in the network, as well as the these Usenet feeds. And for people who don't know what that is, it's really it was really the first asynchronous computer communication system that I know of, which is basically what they called them, news groups, but they were basically discussion areas that were asynchronous, and people would post messages, you know, in a kind of nested fashion, right? And so so Matthew understood Unix, and he knew how it worked, right? So he was the guy, and he was there, and he sets up the well, and they come up with the idea of letting journalists have free accounts. And they also gave free accounts to people who were really good programmers, good Unix programmers. And they did another thing that was really important, other than give you know, journalists free accounts, which of course enabled them to write about it a lot. But the other thing was that back in those days, if you wanted to improve your ability to program in Unix, and you didn't already work for a company that had a Unix system going, or a university where you you know, could, you know, work in their computer lab or whatever, you had really very few opportunities. And to people who were good programmers that sort of gained a level of trust with the well management, which basically meant Matthew, since he was the only guy running it, he would grant some of those people what they called a shell account, which was an account that allowed people not to go into the root binaries. And, you know, you couldn't really change the way the thing ran, but it opened up areas where you could create scripts that did things for the people using the system. And in exchange, you would, you know, have a little resume item, a little portfolio build, and learn things in the process. And so this kickstarted a kind of a gift economy at the well very, very early. And I don't think it gets enough credit, but it was crucially important. It's why Howard Rheingold in the real old days used to call it the meeting place of the tool makers and the tool users. And so after Matthew was running this thing for, it opened in April of 1985. And then by later that fall, it had grown to the point that it had a lot of administrative duties required. And it also needed more money, basically. They needed to grow it more. In those days, because it was its own dial-up system, you would pay an $8 per month fee to have an account, and then you would get metered at $2 an hour, which sounds really expensive now, since we've all embedded this kind of money into these gigantic phone bills that we all pay now. Back in those days, they used to do research on this, that you could hardly get anybody to pay a phone bill over $40 unless they could deduct it as a business or something. You know, that's all different now. But in those days, $2 an hour was really a good deal. So it was cheap. And so Matthew needed someone to help him because he was just a one-man operation. Meanwhile, in 1983, 4 and 5, you know, I had left the farm. I had a small family, a pretty big family of small children, and didn't live too far from Matthew. And we, you know, for those people who don't know, the farm was a very large collective. It's still there, but it really is a cooperative now. But back in the day, when we started in 1970 up through the early 80s, it was a true collective and it was big. And but for various reasons, that collective kind of fell apart and a bunch of us left. It really not germane too much to this particular story, but I left with my family, came back to California where I grew up, and Matthew came back here too because he'd been offered a job. So a lot of farm people did that and moved out to California where the whole thing had begun in the late 60s. But I didn't have very many skills. And the only job I could get was as an auto mechanic down in Marin County. I live in Sonoma County, so did Matthew. This is two counties up from San Francisco. And then Marin is the county that, it's also where Sausalito is, where the well was located. And so the only job I could get was as an auto mechanic. And so I was working at a dealership down in San Rafael, California, and not feeling too happy about it because I felt correctly like I was underachieving pretty bad. Plus, I had a lot of mouths to feed, a lot of kids to raise, and I wasn't making much money. It was a real struggle. And the guy I was working for wasn't particularly honest or kind. And so right at the end of 1985, I got really fed up. And I had saved just enough money that I could keep the family floating for a couple of months. My wife was in school at the time, too. She was not working. So I had just enough money that I quit my job. And I was at a Christmas party at a mutual friend's house, and I was talking to Matthew, and some other people. I was basically whining about my situation, you know, and I was very close to taking another mechanic job. When Matthew said, well, I need some help. Why don't you come work for me? Just out of the blue. I'm like, what? What do you mean work for you? I don't even know. I've never even sat in front of a computer. I don't know anything about this. And he said, oh, no, you can learn. That's okay. You've been trained, you know, by a European automobile company to fix their fuel injection systems. You can learn how computers work. It's not that difficult. And basically, he thought that I had somehow the right personality and maybe a kind of a social hunger too. I think that has to be put on the table. You know, a bunch of us had left this commune that we had staked everything on, and it didn't work, and we left, and it was, you know, we were kind of a little bit adrift, and maybe he sensed that. I don't know. It just completely came out of the blue for me, and but I could see that it was a window of opportunity, and I took it. And so he was like, well, what do you even want me to do? And he said, well, I need a marketing director, you know, someone to help grow it. I'm like, what? Marketing? I don't think I even knew what the term really meant. I mean, I'm serious. I didn't know anything. But his hunch was that I would somehow thrive in this role. And so I did. I showed up to work pretty much at the beginning of 1986. I had never sat in front of a computer. I had, he told me two things when I first got there. He said, first of all, you need a login ID. And I didn't know what that was. I said, what do you mean, login ID? What's that? He said, well, it's what you use to identify yourself. It's kind of like a CB handle. And I had been an interstate truck driver for a couple of years in the mid-70s. And I had a CB handle. Tex. Not because I'm from Texas, but just I was just a tall, skinny guy who liked to wear cowboy shirts. And I talk kind of slow. And I had found this funny, funky cowboy hat in an old car, and I started wearing it, and my friends started calling me that. And, you know, it just came out of nowhere. It was all kind of humorous, but I said, oh, like a CB handle. Oh, okay. Well, I'll use that. So I became tex@well.com, which now, 36 years later, is still my email address, even though I'm not from Texas.
Well, you're time at the farm coincided with my time living in Berkeley, and I encountered people who were both trying to go to the farm and some that were coming back. And it seemed like the problems you mentioned you encountered that caused you to leave are very similar to what you encounter now in you're an online community manager, and there's those same kind of people, the ones who really want to contribute and the others that just want to hang out and show off. Is that what your experience was with the farm and with the online communities?
Yes, although the farm, maybe because it was in person, was much more effective at peer pressure than online communities, where I've always wondered about this, but I think it's because, like, look at us in this situation now. We're talking on a Zoom meeting, but each one of us are, like, I'm in my room here, my home office. I'm in my regular chair. This is pretty much of a power spot for me. Nobody can hurt me, no matter what I do or say. You know, I feel kind of, one can get a little cocky behind that, I think, you know. Also, the thing about the farm was that it was quite hierarchical. And that was acceptable in the early days because it was really kind of guru-based, you know, at first. You know, here's the teacher and the students, and we're going to form this community that's, you know, going to be for us to grow families, but we're going to think of it more like an ashram or something, or a monastery even. We even call it a family monastery. And Stephen, the head guy, was always like the teacher. But you know, that model didn't work well after a while for a couple of reasons. Some of it was just plain good old-fashioned alpha male stuff I've seen play out over and over and over again. You know, so online community management tends to be less hierarchical, for one thing. People online really don't like to be told what to do. And some respond to peer pressure or not, you know, I'm not sure. But
I think you really have a good point there about how, like, when people are online, they don't feel any kind of real social pressure in the same sense that they do when it's a face-to-face situation. People who are the worst kinds of trolls and extremely aggressive online are often nothing like that in real life. And that, you know, has presented a big problem online.
That was true. And if you look at the early well days, if you just read a lot of the stuff, I mean, it was the well was set up socially where it was owned by the Whole Earth Organization and this Larry Brilliant's company. It was co-owned. And so the Whole Earth was charged with managing and operating and everything. So Whole Earth and its employees, which meant Matthew and me at first, were in charge. And then there's this host group who are volunteers who get free accounts and pretty much unlimited time in exchange for their effort. And a lot of these people were very articulate, very accomplished, had solid professional careers and everything. And because governance online was so new, there really was very little in the way of a reference point. Yes, there was CompuServe. Yes, there was, I mean, Usenet and those things, they were largely unmanaged. And so the whole field of community management and the art and science of it didn't exist yet, really. And in fact, I was hired as the marketing director, but, you know, I didn't know anything about marketing. Plus, we didn't have any money. And so we couldn't, you know, we could afford to print a brochure. We printed a little brochure and we bought booth space at computer fairs. Like the West Coast Computer Fair was a big going thing back in those days. And we bought a booth for that. And in fact, I took in March of 1986, I took a big poster, you know, big wide poster of there was a Whole Earth poster that showed the Earth rising from the moon, one of those classic shots. And it had a little in the middle, it said the Whole Earth software catalog. Well, I made a thing that covered that up. And it said, "The Well, the Bay Area's online community." And I'm getting now close to 100% sure that that's the first use of the phrase online community to be used, you know, as a descriptive entity. All of my research and others have shown that here and there in like J.C. Licklider's book in the 60s, and a couple of people would drop the phrase, you know, as they were trying to describe the dynamics of it all, but it really had never been used, you know. And so, and the reason I came to that was because I couldn't afford to do anything really except go to these fairs and, you know, whatnot. And I thought, well, how am I going to market this thing? What, how are we going to grow this thing? And I wasn't there very long when I could see all of, because I had access to some of the admin tools where you could sort of see who was online, what were the dynamics. You couldn't see what they were saying, but you could sort of, you could see a little bit of a dashboard in real time that it was full of people, and that these people were, you know, hooking up with each other in all sorts of ways. And, you know, it just hit me that the best thing that I could do would be to just make this experience be as meaningful as possible to everybody using it, so that they would be enthusiastic about it and get their friends to do it. I couldn't think of any other way to do it. And so when I realized that, then I very quickly saw that the key to the whole thing were the relationships between the individuals. You know, it wasn't, I mean, yeah, you want the software to work well and help you. You want certain things, but at its core, it was really about the relationships between the people and helping to build them. And the thing about living on the farm was that I had physically lived with so many people in so many different situations. From the time I got onto a bus, which is where we started in San Francisco in 1970, to when I left at the beginning of 1983, I counted that I had lived in 15 different households or configurations with somewhere north of 200 different people, both in a bus. And I mean, like at one point there were 10 of us in that bus. So, I mean, we're talking about very close up, living as a single guy on the farm in an army tent for a while with 10 other guys, on an army tent with a wood platform, and then into a house. And then in from 1978 to 1982, we lived in the Northeast, in the South Bronx and in Washington, D.C., because we were part of these social benefit programs that we got going later on. And so I had lived with all of these different people. And I came to see that that was why Matthew had picked me to do it. It didn't have anything to do with computers. It didn't have anything to do with marketing per se. It had to do with, I think, a kind of resilience that you can develop just simply being with so many different kinds of people in so many different situations. Talk about men, women, kids. You know, I lived in a house in D.C. We had a 10-bedroom house in D.C. with 35 people living in there, and half of them were kids, little kids. So, I mean, it was just, so you learn to live with a lot of chaos. You learn to accept that things get messy amongst people. Arguments don't have to ruin everything. And in fact, you can develop a real sense of how bad things really have to get before you give up. And I really think that that came down to a lot of the core of it, because we had developed a kind of resilience, because, you know, those were hard conditions living out there. And anyway, again, it's, I could digress forever about all that, but the point is that, you know, I left that, and I really wanted, I didn't want that whole part of my life to go away completely. I had no idea what might replace it. I don't think any of us did. You know, I wasn't going to go move in with a bunch of ex-farm people. We were also broke. We could barely, you know, pay our own rent. And so, you know, I didn't try to convert anybody into being anything. I didn't try to proselytize. I didn't do any of that kind of stuff. All I did was try to figure out something about the people and why, what would be the things that would make them want to stick around.
And there were some natural communities of people, like I know the Deadheads, people who follow the Grateful Dead in the Bay Area, were a big contingent on the Well early on, and they sort of knew each other and had some sense of community already, right?
Absolutely true. There were these subcommunities, the Whole Earth group being one, of course.
Yeah.
And the Deadheads did bring a lot of crucial things to the party. Well, obviously a sense of fun and a sense that partying and going to concerts is not a waste of time. A lot of these people were really well-paid, skilled professionals, many of them engineers. Many of those Well Deadheads did important engineering things. You know, they weren't like, it was this merging of the counterculture and the tech culture in the Bay Area. And there were many people who were Deadheads who personally embodied it. So yes, they did bring that. And then there was a group of electronic artists, real seminal early days artists, the ArtCom Network. They had a little subgroup. That said, I think for the most part, most of the people who came into the Well were actually unattached to a group, really. They were kind of free electrons. Many of them were writers, freelancers, programmers, people who were doing their own thing for the most part. And
yeah, Howard Rheingold really made the point that the Well gave him a social life he wouldn't otherwise have, because as a writer, he was sort of alone with his typewriter or his computer, as it turned out to be. And he could always just sort of divert his attention for a while to this community of people without having to go anywhere. So that sort of gave him a community that he might not otherwise have had. And I think that was true for a lot of writers who came to the Well.
It was absolutely true. It was true for teachers. There was a bunch of teachers there. Back in those days, you sort of needed a reason to have a computer, unless you were just an enthusiast or a hobbyist. And there were plenty of those people, too, who just came in looking for advice for their printer or something and wound up finding new friends. I mean, that was sort of the magic of it all, really. And that was, I thought, kind of an insight, was that a lot of these people weren't loners, really. They didn't even have bad social skills. They just hadn't really found their little tribe yet, their group. It hadn't really happened to them. And maybe some of them didn't even think that it would. But I can think of lots, and I mean lots of people who came to the Well pretty much on their own, or they were Deadheads and they sort of loosely partied with people, but you know, they really were on their own like that. And they found who later became their best buddies, best friends, even to this day. Absolutely lots of those people. And so to me, that was what it was all about. And also, you know, I had those needs myself. I mean, I had a tribe that I was part of, and I loved those people and everything. But, you know, I was only in my mid-30s, and I needed, you know, I wanted more. I wanted something new and special, you know. And so we all took that journey together. And it was great.
Well, the Well has always had a reputation as, this may not be the right wording, a civilized online community compared to some of the social media communities, if you will, that have popped up in recent years. How would you contrast the two? It's like, say, Facebook, which has a whole different idea of how to run an online community.
You know, you certainly could be a troll on the Well, and some people did do it, but you know, it wasn't a real big operation, and so you would have a pretty high profile if you did that kind of thing. And in a couple of cases, we actually did show someone the door over it. But It's also true, though, that there was a lot of arguing on the well. And this host group used to go into places that were sort of not public. It was like hosts only, where this, you know, online governance would be discussed, shall we say, in spirited terms, you know, such as, you know, when do you choose to get rid of somebody? Do you have that right? Is something censorship or not? If it's censorship, is it ever okay? You know, suddenly you find yourself in these kinds of positions, and a bunch of people who, you know, a lot of Berkeley people, you're from Berkeley, you know, this pretty anti-authoritarian. And yet, on the other hand, everybody's looking at each other's garbage to make sure they're recycling properly.
Well, that sounds a lot more civilized than what you hear coming out of the Facebook world. An artist friend of mine in San Francisco just got out of Facebook jail today. You know, he's a very well-known progressive artist and political activist, and they just keep putting him in Facebook jail, not for, you know, bad things, but just they have AI now that sees certain words and say, well, he's going to cause trouble. Let's put him on timeout. And
I've been put in jail.
Yeah, me too. But the process you described at the well is civilized. I mean, there's nothing uncivilized about debate and argument. That's part of what we do as human beings. It's all in what you do with that debate and with that argument.
Yeah, we had a guy who came in there once who, I've been a member of the well for a long time too. We had a guy who came in and decided he was just going to be disruptive and was really sort of like creating havoc in several conferences on the well. And he wasn't just kicked out. There was actually a sort of online hearing for this guy. I think you were still there, Tex, weren't you, when this happened? You know what I'm referring to? Anyway, they did have a kind of online hearing for him. And I know Howard started what was going to be a commercial online community called Electric Minds that kind of didn't work out and got sold off to another entity. And Howard got this other entity to agree that the members of Electric Minds would be able to have and run their community there, you know, without a lot of interference from the commercial part of it. And there was the same controversy there. People would come in to Electric Minds and be somewhat disruptive, and there would be big conversations among the hosts there about whether to kick people out. And on the other hand, we were trying to start something like a council, a democratic thing, and maybe have hearings and all that. It turned out that stuff would just drone on, and it was really better to just, if somebody came in being disruptive, it was better for somebody to be like the benign dictator and just kick them out. And I think, you know, that probably is true on the well now. I mean, I don't think anybody's been kicked off the well in a long time, but I know it comes up every now and then in discussion. All that stuff's still happening, you know?
Yes, absolutely it is. But right, there's this, the default is to want to not do that. I think that when things get really huge and big like that, it becomes, governance of a group always changes depending on the size of the group. I think this is pretty well studied anthropology, and I certainly experienced it living with people. When you started as a group that, you know, when we got to the farm, there was like less than 300 people. And then it got, after a few years, it was like more than 1,000 people. So you go from knowing everybody to knowing some people and sort of knowing some other people. And then you go to some people, you really just don't know them. They're just there, but I'm sure they're great, but I don't live with them. I don't work with them. And, you know, it's a long, hard day of work, and I don't see them. And so, you know, but then maybe some years later, you'll like things will reconfigure and you'll like live with them or something. But we didn't. But you know, I think that it's true though. The well, they would drone on and it became you can't get any decisions made that way, but it's still the act of the discussion itself is beneficial because, for one thing, if you're the person who has to decide, who will decide, you want to have an open, you want to be receptive to somebody who has a better insight on the situation than you do, maybe, and maybe their advice is good and worth taking, you know. But at some point, if you're the manager, you have to make a decision. My understanding about how Facebook works is that it starts out as complaint driven. I got put in Facebook jail for facetiously saying Sig Heil in response to something, you know, I don't even remember what it was, you know, but it was, you know, one of those things. And so I was like offed, you know, for like days. But in researching how it works, somebody somewhere makes a complaint. And then they decide that, okay, that term is off limits. And then they feed it to the AI. And then the AI will do what Scoop says. They go around and they just find every instance of that and they just kill you right there. Whoop, gone.
Well, on Facebook, they don't have the concept of the host. You might have somebody who sets up a Facebook group and is in effect the host of that group. But generally on Facebook, conversations happen without oversight and without somebody who can step in and break up fights and kind of help people work things out. And
then I think it's a real group. Huh? I think if you're in a group, only if you're in a group, yeah. Somebody can do that, but that's it, you know. But, you know, I've often thought this, that the trouble with them is that they're always going to be in reactive mode. They're always just going to be reacting to, you know, oh, don't do this, don't do that, for whatever kind of pressure that they get. But anything that gives you, the end user, more control, like dilutes the power of their business model. And so, you know, they're not going to do that. They want us to think that they're doing this for us, but they're not. They're doing it to make money from their advertisers.
And, right, we're the product.
Yeah, and so, you know, they need total control over data collection, which means that it seems to me that the only tools they ever give us is when there's enough peer pressure they decide to kind of allow us to do something. But for the most part, you know, it's just up to them, however that experience goes. And it's not, so I think they're always going to be more and more of a nanny state, frankly, because I don't see how else they can do it. If they don't let people manage their own experience,
I can always tell when Facebook is about to come down with some new brilliant idea that's going to piss everyone off, is when there's some movement in a legislative body that calls their actions into question. Then all of a sudden they decide they're going to get a whole new committee to go in and clean all that up, which you never really see it getting cleaned up, but you hear a lot of press releases about it. But, you know, the big problem with Facebook is this AI doesn't have any concept of context. And, you know, one word taken alone, you know, without context, you know, it's pretty much meaningless.
But, you know, Tex brought up a good point earlier about scale. You know, and if you've got a system that has billions of users, it's really hard to get personal with management of conversations. You know, I mean, there could be a structure for doing it. It probably would have to have been set up a long time ago. And I have often thought that the scale of Facebook, the number of users they have on there, is a problem that could, you know, sort of blow up at some point. That it just makes it really, really hard to manage.
It does. I don't see any way to deal with it other than what they're doing now, which is to do some things and, you know, largely not let go of their basic model of how they're going to, you know, make money and proceed. And, you know, if they make people mad some of the time, I'm sure that they're well used to that. But I mean, if you're an adult, you should be able to control what you do and don't want to see, right? I mean, there are a lot of smart people working for that outfit. What if they, you know, made lots of user tools so that you could very finely adjust what you wanted to see or not? Or, I mean, sometimes I'd like to look into what people on the other end of the political spectrum have to say, you know?
Yeah.
And so I would love to have easy ways to do that within the Facebook world. But A, it's not that easy to do it. And B, whatever you do, they're going to start, you know, they think, oh, well, now you're interested in this. Well, therefore, we're going to, you know, start adjusting your experience so that you get more of that, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, the whole thing strikes me as kind of Skinnerian, you know, in a way. You know, what conditioning will you best respond to that keeps you there, keeps you scrolling, you know, which is the kind of the real goal, which is so fundamentally different than the idea of letting people hash out their views, which is naturally a really messy kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I keep thinking that there's going to be an exodus of people away from Facebook into the well. And I know that some people have already made that move. I've continued to be a member of a well and a host there for a long time, but I was less active for a time because of, you know, social media sort of pulled me and others away. And I've gone back. You know, I don't want to spend much of my time on Facebook. I'd rather spend it on the well, where I can have real conversations with real people and have a real sense of community.
Yeah. And to me, it's all kind of these days, it all kind of blends together in various systems. And I mean, between Facebook, Twitter, the well, email, Zoom meetings, the online systems I'm affiliated with now, you know, it all kind of, you know, blends together for me in a way. You know, I don't stay on any one thing, but it is true. The well, in fact, I mean, you're the host of the Well Media Conference, which is a really busy place. There's a lot of people in there who have a lot to say about just about everything. Yeah. And man, that's, you know, it takes as long to read that as the New York Times.
It's daunting. I mean, I know some people have avoided going into that conference because there's so much activity there. But once I made a real commitment to it, I found, you know, it wasn't that hard to keep track. Because there's so much activity there, it you know, this, the management of the conference is pretty hard. And there was one guy managing it for the longest time, for the most part. And I think it was about to drive him nuts. So other people have joined in, especially after there was a big conflict in there, as will happen from time to time on the well. That was very hard to figure out how to, like, sort of control or deal with. And, you know, if you have somebody who comes into the conversation and decides they're going to blow things up, then that can be hard to manage. And it can take a lot of time and effort to figure out how to deal with that, especially if you don't want to be like, do some kind of like unilateral ban or something like that. And it is possible to ban somebody from a discussion, but that's not where you really want to go if you can avoid it.
No, and it backfires a lot too. No matter how much of a nuisance somebody's being, there's always a certain amount of people who are going to object, because it's very hard to make those kind of decisions, you know, really cleanly and unemotionally, you know, and all of that. So, but also, you know, the internet is a big place now. It's huge, it's vast. And I think that pretty much any kind of encounter you want to have is available to you if you look for it enough, which is of course great. You know, I mean, there's nobody that says you have to be on any of those big social media platforms. And in fact, I know plenty of people who have rich online lives who don't use them at all, because there are so many opportunities, and there are even some that are kind of secretive, or they don't want anybody to know about them. And these kind of decentralized, there's a big trend among a lot of young online people that they don't like this centralization and this collection of concentration of power in these big orgs. And so there's a system that's run out of New Zealand, for example, called Scuttlebutt, that is people, it's a network based on personal recommendation and people vouching for each other. So anybody can download the software and sign up to it. But if you go in there, you won't see anybody there unless you know somebody and you know how to contact them, and then they can vouch for you. And then if they do, then you have access to the people they have. You know, it's sort of like that. But the other thing about it is that it runs outside of the whole IP address world. And the people that go in there have rich social lives with each other, and they don't talk about it to anybody else. You know, which I also happen to know that has made for some very interesting opportunities for people to go in there and plan bad things, shall we say. But that's not why they set it up. They set it up because, you know, they wanted to be more anonymous and outside of the view of central control. And then there are gazillions of online services designed for all kinds of groups and hobbies and support groups. I mean, you name it, it's out there. And so I also think, because of that fact, it maybe isn't necessary to get too worked up if you decide to show someone the door. Yeah. I mean, it's not like there's nothing out there. You know, back in 1988, I think there was kind of a, if you put somebody out, like, where would they go? Very tough, very different world it was.
Well, the other thing is that if, let's say you're a member of the Well or some online community like that, and you really have a rich social life that's based there, getting kicked out could be, you know, pretty devastating even now. I mean, you might have other places to go or other ways to connect with people, but you lose a context that was really meaningful for you.
Well, we had this one guy, this was in, I don't know, maybe 1990. He was the guy, Tom, who'd been written about in the Wired story.
Yeah, Tom Mandel.
Tom Mandel, yeah. And he was a really brilliant guy. And because he was, partly because he was so knowledgeable about so many things, and incredibly articulate and a tough debater. You know, he was very ubiquitous, but we trusted him. And so we gave him some extra powers, because sometimes on the weekends, you know, we needed a break too. You know, sometimes he was like a backup guy, and, you know, in case, and it was, and so we gave him a certain access to certain tools. And one of them wasn't just like kicking someone out or removing them, or like, what you could do was that you could go in behind the scenes if you had the permission to do it, and you wouldn't like kick them out of the user roles. You would end their process, and in other words, knock them offline. You could just go in there, and every time they showed up, beep, like that. And he did that. His girlfriend, who, you know, he got in a deep relationship with this woman. It was very complicated. And if you want to read the story, it's in that Wired piece, but he,
and the book, right?
And the book. And it went very badly with them for a while. And so he invoked these powers to do things to her. One of them was that he set up a little alert thing that every time she'd log in, it would tell him that he'd go in and knock her process out. So he made it so she couldn't log in. And when we found that out, we said, okay, Tom, we're going to put you off the system for a time. I don't remember what a month or something like that. And so he sort of went, oh, yeah. And so right as we were doing that, he was able to go use this other tool that this guy had written, and he could go into every conference where he had commented, which was everywhere, and scribble that comment. In other words,
he didn't remove all
vaporized. Yeah, he vaporized himself and basically turned the whole well into a block of Swiss cheese. I mean, it was just, suddenly it was full of holes, and we had to rebuild it. We were able to rebuild it, but it was very, very difficult and painstaking. And so that was a case where somebody let his own emotions get a hold of him and used those tools to really alter the experience for other people.
I actually did that one time too, but not every conference where I'd posted, but maybe a specific conference or two where I was unhappy with the way things were going. And, you know, it was an emotional thing for me too, and it was a stupid thing to do. And I think Tom, I regretted it, and I know Tom did too.
He did, yeah, later. Yeah, it was, yeah. That was the thing. Or, this other guy, there was this brilliant guy on the well back in the like 89 and 90 named Blair Newman.
I remember Blair Newman.
Remember, yeah. Blair Newman? Blair Newman, yeah. Was really brilliant. And he conceived of, he could see into the future of media really well. Really clearly, he could see where all this stuff was going. He could see that all the media was going to merge, that it was all going to be, you know, in his way of thinking, like on a belt clip, you know, like a pager. Remember pagers, you know? Well, yeah. Now it's a watch. I mean, it doesn't matter, that kind of stuff. But I mean, he could see all that stuff. And he had, he had worked for Howard Hughes and done all kinds of crazy things. And apparently when he was really feeling it, was one of the best pitch men ever, which was part of why Hughes liked him. And so, but he ultimately committed suicide, which he was very, he was just troubled, you know, he was actually, I liked him a lot, but when he left, he did it too, right before. It was like the day before he decided.
Didn't he sort of announce what he was doing and people were trying to get to him to stop him?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think he did. He sort of told everybody what he was going to do.
Well, you know, you were talking a little bit earlier about everybody being sort of adults, but I think one of the things were in things like that. I mean, I know that when I did something emotional like that, it was pretty childish. And I think that adults, you know, I mean, Tom Mandel was a pretty mature and accomplished guy, but he did some dumb things sometimes. And I think that's one of the things that we have always had to deal with in online communities is that people do get emotional and they do revert to, you know, less mature ways of acting from time to time. But you don't want to just, you know, you don't, well, in today's terminology, you say you don't want to cancel them. You don't want to completely remove them, but you want to help them get back, you know. And that's the challenge.
It is. It is a challenge. Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I like to keep it on a human scale. I like to feel like I'm, you know, talking to people. It's always been a tool for me. It's always, meeting face to face was always a really important part of what we did. And one of you guys early on were talking about a troll, but then if you met them, they were, well, they were really, you know, rather gentle folk. And we had a lot of that experience too, as well. Some of those well guys would, particularly the ones who were they were good programmers and they were heavy Usenet users. This is where the term flaming came from. And it came specifically from the comics, right? Flame on, you know, and then they would just trash whoever they were trying to trash and then flame off, you know, and then go back to being, you know, normal programmer person. But we had a lot of these. They were mostly guys, not all, but they were real hotheads sometimes. And then they would show up at these well parties and they were just very gentle people.
I can think of several. I can think of one guy in particular that, you know, we just like were like this all the time. We were like coming to blows, having arguments and flames and that sort of thing. And then we met face to face and became really good friends.
I know, it's amazing how that can work. And I think part of that is that no matter how much we try and compensate, and now we have video and everything, it's not just typing, it's still stepped down from the full experience. And so I always feel that you need to always know that going in, which means that the odds that you're going to misunderstand something are much greater. And the odds that somebody is going to somehow not convey as well whatever they're trying to convey as they otherwise might have, you know, sets the online medium up for being very easy to fall into misunderstanding and thus fall into conflict. And also, it's because of that same set of handicaps, it's hard to get out of conflict when you're online. And you know, so
we have a cat that is kind of cranky a lot and difficult. And we discovered that we could buy these gadgets that have pheromones with them, and the pheromones heat. And, you know, the pheromone scent is in the air. And we put that in a couple of rooms and she calms way down and becomes so much easier to deal with. And I think maybe what's missing online is pheromones. You know, maybe there's something about that physical presence that we convey that you just can't possibly convey through an online medium.
Right. So you have to kind of conjure it up for yourself and in a way for whoever you're with when you're with them online. That's what I think. And the way I put it is, I advise people to oversupply understanding. Oversupply understanding, because somebody's, maybe they didn't say it exactly perfectly, or maybe you didn't hear it right, or maybe this, or maybe that, you know? I mean, the slack cutting, the art of slack cutting, I think is very important for keeping one from getting too kind of uptight in the experience, because, you know, we're all just such imperfect beings, and, you know, we have lots of tools to help us, but we still screw up all the time.
With that, we have reached the end of the hour, and I'm sure there's lots more we could talk about. We'd love for you to come back and talk to us again.
All right, John, Scoop, thanks again.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.